This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. Welcome to A Life in Film.
I'm Elliot James Langridge. I'm an actor, writer, and apparently a podcaster. And I love film. This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
Previous guests include Dexter Fletcher, Natalie Emmanuel, Antonia Thomas, Lucinda Sison, and Lucy Bevan.
Our guest today has championed Indigenous casting from the very start of her career. One of her very first jobs was casting the extras in multi-award-winning classic Dances with Wolves. Becoming a casting director in her own right, she's cast projects ranging from The Twilight Saga to Hostile starring Christian Bale and the best Predator sequel since the original, Prey. Most recently, she's cast Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. Our guest today is casting director Bene Haynes.
It's a life and fail!
This wealth should come to us.
Their time is over.
It's just going to be another tragedy.
When this money started coming, we should have known it came with something else. They're like buzzards circling our people. We're still warriors.
To kill these white men who killed my family. I need you here.
I am right here.
You've got to take back control of your home.
I was sent down from Washington, D.C. to see about these murders.
See what about them?
See who's doing it.
What was the initiation? What was the thing that kind of, you know, piqued your interest and got you into the casting game? And How did that all begin for you? What was the first kind of the love of casting? Where did that come from?
As a child, I was a voracious reader, but I was always very in my head visual. So as a little girl, I would put maybe the neighbor's voice in the book, and I would picture the neighbor in the book as I was reading. And to that point, I hadn't seen a movie with live action. And then one day, my mom took me to the movies, and I saw people up on the screen. And it just kind of clicked for me. And I said to my mother when we came out of the movie, I want to be the person that puts the people in the movies. That's sort of the nucleus of it. I did absolutely nothing with that. Didn't even think of that as a career, but that is always was in the back of my head growing up, because I was probably about six.
Six. And that was, wow. So really early on where you were like, this is amazing. This is something I want to,
yeah. Because I still had to do it with my books. I still had to visualize my books as I was reading them growing up.
That's a really interesting way of comparing it, actually, because you, when you do read a book, you are automatically, without even thinking about it, you're casting the characters in the book, aren't you? In it, that I particularly remember reading like the first Harry Potter book when I was a young kid, and you kind of imagine what it's going to be, and then when you see the films come out, you're like, oh yeah, it's kind of a version of what I thought, but it's not quite the same. Oh, that's interesting that that was a kind of, you know, the first initiation. And was there any kind of, obviously your mum took you to the cinema. Was there, were your parents at all kind of, were they pivotal in the kind of inspiration of movies and getting into film?
Only that they supported whatever I wanted to do. I mean, they weren't in the industry themselves. But they were very interesting, articulate, fun, creative people. So I think that, you know, that the I think that the greatest thing anybody can instill in their child or any young person that they're encouraging is just confidence. They gave me confidence that I could do anything.
And you said that obviously at the age of six, you didn't, you know, do something about it and kind of
Oh
go
no.
from that age. When, what was the, how old were you when you kind of went, okay, actually, that's what I want to do?
After my time at university, I went, well, I studied theater, acting and directing at university. I studied actually as a high school student. I went to the UK and studied acting. And then after university, did a little tour, my one professional gig. And then I had been like with a local, very successful theater company that did original theater, dinner theater. And as we were a dinner theater, we were part of the Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber of Commerce kind of kept a listing of all of the creative professionals in the area. And a casting director, Laura Kennedy, was coming to Montana, where I was living with my family, to travel to the Seven Reservations for a film that she was casting, and she needed an assistant or somebody to help her on this trip. And the chamber or the film commission went down their list. I was not high on the list. I was very low on the list, but they went down their list and nobody was available. And when they came to me, I was like, that sounds really interesting. I'd love to go. Not ever having any aspirations of thinking it would lead to my life, but it did. We went on this great trip to these seven reservations, and one day, as we were traveling it by car, Laura said to the producers, "Hey, you know what? This girl gets along really well with everyone, and I think you should engage her to do the extras on the film." And so that was the beginning,
Wow.
and we go from there.
There's a lot to be said to being able to get on with anyone, you know, being able to chat to people and be kind of relaxed about it. And I find that with I'm an actor myself, and on set you do see the people that tend to go further. I mean, obviously talent and all these other things that you need, but if you can just get on with it and get on with the people around you, I think that's such a huge help. And that was obviously something early on for you that really helped you get where you are now.
It was everything. It because the I mean the reason my whole reasoning for my area of focus had everything to do with being able to get along with people and treating everyone with respect. That's what's the most important to me.
And I'm really intrigued to, obviously you said there that, I mean, that particular project to cut, you've cast a lot of indigenous characters. Is that, was it that job that kind of started that trend in your career?
Yes, absolutely. It was we were filming on the Blackfeet Reservation in Browning, Montana, and I had been hired. I was engaged to cast all the I had hundreds in this film that I needed. So I had, it was about 2 weeks away from filming, and I decided to do one more open call. And I was in the basement of a local, the Blackfeet Catholic Church, setting up, you know, I set up my little thing there, and pretty much I'd caught everybody already that wanted to be in the movie, but I really wanted to have one more day of, just in case somebody really wanted to sign up and I hadn't seen them. So nobody came in. Nobody came in during the morning. And then in the afternoon, a few people trickled in from the tribal council and our local liaison, who was always so wonderful. And she came in with a few people. And during that time, this gentleman came in, whose name is, he called himself Junior. And I went over to him and I said, "Hi, are you here to sign up for the movie?" And he said, "What do I have to do?" And I told him, I said, "It's really super easy. You just fill this application out and I take your picture and you're on your way and I will find a place for you." And he reluctantly said, "Well, I can't read." I said, "Oh, it's okay. I'll sit with you. We'll fill it out together and blah, yada, yada." And so as we were sitting there filling out his application, it was very apparent that he was very down on his luck, and very unfortunate situation. But we persevered. We got it done. And I told him, I said, "No matter what, you find somebody that can get in touch with you." Now, this is the mid-80s. Nobody had cell phones. But and not a lot of people had home phones where we were. And I said, "But no matter what, here's my card. You call me and let me know who to call to get in touch with you, and I will." He leaves the tribal, the council leaves, our associate leaves, and me sitting there for the next 4 hours. Maybe one or two people trickle in. So then, it's 15 minutes until time to go home, and this tiny little grandma in a babushka comes in and she sits at the furthest table from me. And I went over and I said, "Hi, are you here to sign up for the movie?" And she goes, "What do I have to do?" And I told her, and she says, "Okay, I'll do it." And I said, "Okay, you sit here and I'll go get the application for you." And I went back to the table, my back was to her, and I heard this rush of somebody coming up behind me, and I thought I was going to be stabbed or something. I mean, that's, I had that instantaneous fear for my life for some reason, because it was so out of, it was so incongruous what was happening and what I could hear. And I turn around and it's the little grandma now standing up full height and pulling out the scarf and wig off, and a man's voice is coming out. And he's going, he said, "You know what? You're too nice. I can't do this to you anymore." I was like, "What are you doing?" And he was the same guy that had played Junior earlier. And it was basically the community and the leaders of the community kind of making sure Hollywood treated every individual, no matter how down on their luck they were, and particularly their elders, with high regard and respect. Wow. And because they were not going to like really put their stamp on us working in their community with them if we didn't pass that. And, you know, I was raised really well, so of course I was going to be nice to everyone, but it really, that profoundly affected me, and it affected the way that I move in every community since then. So I'm so grateful that it was literally my second job ever in the industry. And I have used that through my career. And just like, I have found that the Indigenous communities that I've gone to, and I've gone to so many throughout North America, that principle holds with all of them. And so I have such a high regard for that, for people who take care of their communities like they do.
Wow, that's amazing. And no wonder it stuck with you. You kind of thinking, oh,
well, sure.
You never know.
Yeah, and you know, because I that same film a few here's how I became very fortunate to have this specialty. That same film a few weeks later, I was sitting, I would always have lunch with my extras, and I was sitting with the elders on that were on set with us that day. And I asked the gentleman why it was that when I would try to take Polaroids, back when we were doing Polaroids of everyone, I said, when I take a photo of anyone, they don't look at me. They look away. And I don't understand. It's like very, very prevalent through everybody I'm taking photos of. And they, you know, they told me the story about how in their culture, it feels like you're stealing their soul or part of their soul if you take their photo, which is, you know, that's not just specific to that culture. It's a lot of cultures around the world feel that way. And so I could never throw those pictures away.
Yeah.
And we had a file of the 7 reservations in Montana of anybody anywhere who wanted to be in film. They'd come to our open call. So then one after another, other people would say, hey, I heard you have the file, you know. So I, you know, for many, many years, I kept those, that original set of photos.
That's they must be very iconic, especially if everyone's kind of trying to keep their eye away from the camera. What happens if they're doing like a costume, you know, continuity photo?
You know what, everyone eventually got over
it. Yeah,
it was a trust issue in the beginning, and once you earn trust, it's a little different. There would be some that wouldn't, but you know. I didn't really look into all of the wardrobe continuity photos. I don't know how those went, but I'm sure they got better.
Yeah. And I noticed that, and I didn't realize, I was very familiar with your career and I'm a big fan of a lot of the stuff you've done, but I didn't realize that you were involved in the extras on Dances with Wolves, which is obviously what an amazing job that must have been so early on in your career. I mean, I believe in 1990. So
in 1989, we were filming that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was there for 6 months. I think I Elizabeth Lustig, who did the casting, and I did the initial trip around South Dakota together to find the day players and, you know, local roles and stuff. Don't get me wrong, Elizabeth was fully responsible for those roles, but I kind of set up the tour for us and we did the traveling together. And it was a labor of love for everyone who did it, but none of us knew what we were doing, you know, that what we were doing was going to be so profoundly beautiful. Until Kevin used to have dailies synced and set up and screened for the key crew every evening when we could. And they would set it to temp track music and we'd see these beautiful shots and vistas. And I mean, you grew to understand very early on that what he was filming was spectacular. And I'm still friends with so many of those people.
That's amazing as well, because I mean, it's my maths is terrible, but it's over 30 years ago. So it's crazy that, you know, it's one of those films that has become, and it even at the time there was a lot of controversy around it. But then when it came out and it did amazingly well, it won all the awards. It was, and now it's just like this film that has, you know, beaten the test of time. It's just, it's iconic. And for it to be such an early credit as well, that must have been was that a huge help in your career?
I would say yes. And it was a turning point in my career. Because it was hard work, that film. suffice to say, I was an extras coordinator, and we had hundreds of extras almost every day, and we would house them, and I would get up and go to set with them. And so I was like getting home from a two hour drive location at 2 a.m. And then it felt like I was getting up and in the car by 5 to drive to where they were to get them 2 hours away to set to get ready. I mean, it was a grind. Mm. And so after that film, I was like, okay, you know what? I really want to cast. I really want to cast actors. And I had moved to Los Angeles after that film. And I had been offered a couple of really interesting and big films to do extras on. And I had decided I'm not going to do extras anymore. And, you know, I want for my sanity. And because I wanted, don't get me wrong, I think extras are extremely important. I think that without them, your film is very flat. So I always like to say, the director and the actors paint the foreground, the designers paint the background, and we extras, we atmosphere, we paint the middle. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think it's so important. But I needed to do something else. So for a year, I passed on everything that was offered. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting around having coffee one morning, and in the paper it said TNT announces mammoth Native American series of films for television. And as I was sitting there having my coffee that morning, I thought, who do I know that can call TNT and tell them I'd love to talk to them? Before I was done with my coffee, Iris Grossman from TNT, who was the head of casting, called me. So it's there's a lot of luck and good fortune involved. But also, you know, you're only as good as your last job. And if people say nice things about you, mm-hmm. you know, somebody else might call.
Oh, it's mad, isn't it, how it can be a real snowball effect. You know, that mm-hmm. that first job, and then they all kind of feel connected in some way. And in terms of you know, going from doing a lot of jobs where you were casting the extras, and then going on and you know, working.
Actually, I'd only had a few jobs. I'd only had 4, 1, 2, 3. Dances with Wolves was my 4th job ever.
Wow, that's amazing. That's like insane.
Yeah. I went from Dances with Wolves to casting those TNT films, which were groundbreaking at the time because they were very dedicated to accurate casting and developing a crew of artisans who were Indigenous for behind the camera. And a lot of those people in those early TNT films are now department heads.
Mm.
So I never trained. I never worked with another casting director except for Laura Kennedy, who I traveled around, and she got me the gig as the extras on that first movie.
Wow. So going from, you know, that, I mean, that's amazing in such a short, not necessarily a short space of time, but such a short list of credits. And then suddenly you were, you know, in charge. And did that feel, was that daunting, or were you kind of like, no, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. It feels natural.
It felt natural. It didn't feel daunting because I've never been afraid to ask questions and say, hey, I don't know. How should I do this? Or not, how should I do it? I had to make my own way. When I got the job as the extras coordinator on the first film, I had never done that job. That was like throwing me into the fire. But I'm a MacGyver. I figure things out. I think that you know, anytime you work in this kind of job, especially with extras and to a large degree casting too, you've got to be able to troubleshoot and think on your feet and pivot quickly. On that first film, which is a little movie called War Party, there was a day that they had a rain prediction, but I had 250 people showing up for background. And I'd say 50 of them were bringing brown horses, which I could only hire people with brown horses for this one segment. And they were coming from all over Montana and with horse trailers, and nobody had cell phones. And the I get a radio call from the production office saying the producer wants to see me 70 miles away where they were filming. So get in my truck and I drive 70 miles and he's there and he says, I'm so sorry to do this to you, but, and I had just finished confirming everyone. And he says, I'm so sorry to do this to you, but we have to cancel. It's going to be so rainy that we can't have people laying on the ground and stuff like they needed to be doing. And I was like, okay. And you know, what could I do? I had to just kind of fix it. So I had to figure out, how do I get in touch with all these people? So I went to the local radio station and I said, can you make an announcement right away? And tell me what other radio stations I need to call to get word out to people and tell them to tell their friends to tell their friends in case there's somebody that's an extra. And I called the biggest city that had a TV station. I said, can I do a public service announcement on the news tonight just to tell people not to come? And they all said yes. And I got the copy out to everybody. I drove back to the set or to the production office. They radioed again, said, Bernie wants to see you again. I drive all the way back out there. He says, I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to go forward with it anyway, despite the rain. Just like, and do you know, I got everybody but maybe three people that showed up.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, it was a success. I don't know how I did it. I wanted to drive off into the ditch, but I didn't. You know, it worked out. But, you know, and there was another time, like the whole thinking on your feet and MacGyvering things is, I had an actor that I was trying to reach and he didn't have a telephone. It was a young man. I had an actor who couldn't get to the set or couldn't get into the country or something because of immigrations. And I needed somebody on the set the next day. So the next kid was this young boy in South Dakota. Family's phone was out of service. How do you find him? How do you get him? You send flowers. I called the police. I said, I called all these people. And I said, how can you just drive over there and tell them I need them to call me? Nobody would do it. And so I sent them flowers and I said, call me collect, get to a phone and call me collect. I need you on a plane tomorrow. And, you know, we did it. We got him. So it's little things like that, that, you know, made it feel not daunting because that's just my nature. I figure it out.
It must feel so much easier now to just pick up the phone and be able to get hold of anyone or email or.
Yeah.
That sounds like a very difficult situation. All those challenges that now hopefully are no longer challenges.
It's, there's still sometimes unique challenges, but yeah, everything is doable. And, you know, I think I might panic a little bit more now, even though there's more access to people. But it's just that everything is the heightened intensity of the situation.
Mm. Oh, that's mad, isn't it? Things have changed. Things have changed.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that in your career, there's been a few people that you've worked with on projects along the way and you've worked with them again. Well, obviously, Kevin Costner is an obvious one with Dances with Wolves and then Yellowstone. And, you know, having a gap between two projects like that, what is that like, you know, meeting someone you've worked with before again at a completely different time in your career, both of you in a completely different time of your career as well? Mm-hmm. What were the differences between the first time and the recent time that you worked together? It must have been fairly different.
Well, to be honest, I didn't have anything to do with Kevin being on Yellowstone, and I never met him during the course of Yellowstone because I didn't go to the set or anything like that. But I am doing his Project Horizon. I'm casting the Native characters for that. And it was great fun because there's been three times I've worked with Kevin. I worked, my very first job was on The Untouchables.
Oh, amazing.
I lived in Great Falls, Montana, where they shot the Canadian border bridge sequence. So cast all of the dead bad guys and the Canadian monkeys. So, and I did actually get to meet him during that time, which was like when he was blowing up and so popular. And then Dances with Wolves, he created a big family of crew. It was like we all went through this extraordinary experience together. And then I might have crossed paths with him a few times after that, but then when we would talk on the phone and for Horizon, it was like no time had passed. He's just as lovely now as he was then. But I certainly don't want to take any credit for Yellowstone because that was not me that put him in that.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Those Horizon as well is one that obviously it's not many people know what that's kind of going to be, but it's one of those, you know, you see the credit on IMDb as a pending thing and you hear what it's about and it's Kevin Costner and you kind of, it gets people excited that it could be kind of, you know, the Dances with Wolves type of thing. Is there anything you can say about that, or is it all quite under wraps?
There's like that. Nothing I can say.
Absolutely nothing.
No, I'm not at liberty to really share, other than that I'm working on it.
Yeah, no, that's very exciting. No, I cannot wait for that one. I have to be honest as well. Dance with the Wolves was a film that it kind of felt like, you know, a really expensive bottle of wine that you've got, and you're like, well, I'll save that for a special occasion. I didn't get to watch Dances with Wolves until a year ago. And it was one of those movies that I'd always wanted to watch, but I'd always put it off because I was like, I know that I need to sit down and really like concentrate on it because I know it's a long film and people have always said it's amazing. And me and my girlfriend sat down and watched it on a Sunday last year, it was. And I watched it. I just thought, all this time, why did I not just watch it? It's like, absolutely loved it. It's such an incredible movie. And it feels like it's kind of like one of those films, a bit like Goodfellas, or a film that spans over such a vast amount of time. And it feels like you're watching like Giant as well, a film that has like depth in terms of its characters and its story and its timeline. I don't know why I'm saying this, but I just wanted to say that it's amazing that that was one of your first movies. And that you were involved with, like, yeah, I can't imagine one of those films as well. You think, God, the amount of extras in that film must have been insane. Because it is a film with huge amounts of background artists as well.
But you know what? When you do something like that early in your career, you can take the next steps and keep going. So it was a great education for me too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've worked with some of the absolute greats in your career as well, and I'm hunting back to a film that actually I was very fond of in my childhood, and I haven't seen it for a long time, and it's made me want to watch it again. Talking to you, but that was Grey Owl, the Pierce Brosnan movie that came out, I believe, in the late 90s, 99. Obviously, that was Richard Attenborough.
Right.
He's an icon.
Lovely.
Absolutely icon.
Lovely gentleman. Grey Owl was my second collaboration with Richard. The first being In Love and War. Mm. And what a just lovely gentleman. And Grey Owl was a particularly passion project of his, as I understood it from his own words. He spent years trying to bring that to the screen, and we had had a false start with it at one point, with a cast member that wasn't available at the time that they needed to film, so they delayed and filmed it again a bit later. But over the course of the years, it was always thrilling for me when in the middle of the night my fax machine would go off, because that's how we communicated with the time difference from the UK, and that hearing that fax machine in the middle of the night. But I had done In Love and War with them, and then got this. I still have the facts of them sending me saying, Richard would love to work with you again on this one. Mm. So special.
Yeah, he was, he was just not only a phenomenal actor, but director as well. And it's kind of crazy. I always forget that his brother is David Attenborough as well. It seems obvious, but what talented Richard, brothers.
And Richard said that he and David had queued up to see the real Archie Leach when they were boys.
Oh, wow.
And who knows, perhaps because Archie was the original environmentalist, maybe this was influential to his brother as well, because of his phenomenal career.
Now for a quick break. Are you a writer, director, actor, costume designer, perhaps makeup artist? Are you interested in camera? This is the place to share your journey. We want to hear from you. How did you start your career? Has it started yet? And perhaps, if you're feeling brave, share with us your most embarrassing film-related moment. So slip into our DMs at Life and Film Pod on Instagram. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm. Where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, at Life in Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge, Life in Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the downtimes, and I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show.
A lot of people who listen to this podcast are interested in, you know, getting into the film industry themselves, or they're at the kind of early stages. For someone that wants to get into casting, do you have any advice for the people that are kind of starting out now?
I do. I think that you should certainly have an aptitude and a thirst for knowledge about actors. You need to have almost a encyclopedic resource in your head about actors. And I always think that successful casting directors, and I'm talking about the titans of casting, not myself, but successful casting directors are people who the directors that work with them again and again and again because they trust their taste. And that's something that I learned from Richard Attenborough and several of the other European directors that I worked with, is that when working with Richard, we did not read actors, we met actors because he trusted my taste in actors, and he trusted me only to bring him people that I'd already vetted and knew their work. So know your subjects, know your work, know and be interested and be supportive and be all things enthusiastic about acting and actors.
And to go off the advice question again, in terms of people coming in as an actor, do you have any advice? I mean, I know, personally, going into a room sometimes can be, it can be very nerve-wracking. You can sometimes your nerves get the better of you. But do you have any advice for people coming in to read for you?
We've
It's always hard to
always,
stand out.
yeah. Well, standing up. Okay, I have a few little tidbits, and
Okay.
your listeners have probably heard all of these. But number one, you wouldn't be going into the room if the people in the room didn't want you to be there because their time is valuable. So you're only getting in that room because we want you there. And wow, we want you to do well. We want to be supportive, you know. And so don't think of it in terms of these people are judging me. Think of it in terms of these people are on my side and are trying to help me get this gig. Number two would be I once got some advice when I was pitching. I also do a little producing, and I was getting ready to pitch something. And someone gave me this great advice, and I like to pass it on to actors. They said, go in the room, do your best, leave it there, and have someplace else more important or more enjoyable to go immediately after. Like maybe it's, hey, I'm going to take my dog to the park and play with my dog, and I really look forward to that. Just go and do have something you're looking forward to so that you know the energy is moving forward and not just all left in the room and stopped. I think that it just gets it, the momentum gets you through it. It really helps with pitching, I think. And then there was one other thing, but I had COVID once, so I have COVID
That's a really good shout though, because I find that sometimes when you go in for an audition, obviously that's your whole day is revolving around doing that.
brain.
And when you come out, I find that I get on the tube and I'm still mumbling the lines like a complete weirdo.
That's natural because when we leave this podcast, I'm going to say, gosh, I should have said it like this. You know, that's human nature. We all do that. But if you were thinking about getting to that coffee date you just made with your friend from high school that you haven't seen in 5 years, you're not going to be thinking about, oh, I should have done it like this because there's nothing you can do. It's done. It's in the record books. And the worst thing would be to have your agent call up and say, oh, you know what? He wasn't quite happy with that. Can he do it again? You know, I know that there are some circumstances where that might be okay, but you know, do your best. in the moment. Know that everybody there is rooting for you. And I did once have an actor who I brought in for a callback. This is a cautionary tale. I brought this guy in for a callback, and he was my guy. He was the one that I needed this director to like, because I really didn't have a good solid backup for this role. And it was quite an elderly director who's no longer with us, but it wasn't Richard Attenborough. And this actor did a brilliant job. We were in a tiny, small hotel conference room in Toronto, and the director had flown in that late that evening before, and this was my second guy of the day. He did brilliantly, and then he just stayed in the room and talking, and he became himself. He left the character, and he had this manic energy that suddenly my director, after I finally got this actor out, and it was just me and the director, I didn't have an assistant or anything at the time because it's years and years ago, my director left. He made a phone call to his people, I guess, and he came back and he said, I can't work with that guy. His energy is too. I gotta go. I'm flying back now. I mean, this guy had totally drained this man of his will to continue with the day full of callbacks that we had.
Oh, so wow.
The tale is, if you've done well, don't
get out.
Don't mess it up by if they ask you a question. You know, of course you're going to answer and everything, but leave them with the work. Don't leave them with a completely different personality that's not the work. That's my experience and little thing.
Yeah, that's something I've never thought of before. I'm going to remember that for sure. Because sometimes when you're nervous as well, you can end up just chatting and
sure. You know,
get out.
Yeah, auditioning is this necessary evil that we have to go through, but it's so unnatural and so unnerving to everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're my team and I are as desperate in the room as you are. So just know that the room, it supports you.
Yeah.
That would be my advice.
I guess you just want someone to come in and be, you know, just come in and give you the answer to that casting. And that's all you want. You just want to see the character. And that's, I guess, as an actor, you've got to remember that. You've just got to try and do your best.
Yeah, I want to see yourself you bring to the character. I don't want you to play a character. What I never want to see is the acting. If we see the acting, we chances are you lose the part.
And to go back to your career, I'm a huge fan of Predator. So when I heard that Prey was coming out, I was apprehensive. We've had a lot of ups and downs in terms of the sequels to Predator, and I was just absolutely blown away by that movie. I don't want to, you know, dump on any of the other Predators, but it was easily the best since the original, and I just absolutely loved it. Yeah. When you got the call to cast that, were you a fan of the original? Was it something you were like, oh yeah, this is a lot of pressure to get right, and it's such a different take as well on the franchise.
I am ashamed to say that I've never seen the original.
No,
I haven't. I've seen clips of it. I'm a girly girl that doesn't like anything gory or scary or anything like that, which, considering some of the movies I've done, it's pretty out there. But what the original movie was, and I knew it was iconic because I have brothers and I have lots of friends who love the movie. And I'd seen clips, but it had nothing to do with the what I was tasked with doing, which was what was on the paper and what was Dan Trachtenberg's vision and what the studio wanted. And, you know, we had our marching orders and we were what went before us didn't really matter to what I was tasked to do. So,
such an incredible film. And in the center of that movie, a performance that the whole film is shouldered on that performance. It feels like that was a key moment in the casting.
I like to say I've known Amber since before her parents knew each other. I knew her parents when they were young. And her mother, Angelique Midthunder, is now like a dear friend and a casting colleague of mine. She also casts Indigenous films. Amber's dad is David Midthunder, who is an actor and a stuntman. And Angelique, before she did casting, was a stunt woman. So it's like Amber was born to play this role. But it, you know, it wasn't a shoo-in for her to play the role. We looked far and wide. We started in the Comanche community, as we like to do on any Indigenous film. We like to try to reach out to the community which we're portraying first. And we did many open calls over the course of a couple years before we settled on the short list of people that we screen tested. Amber is someone that the studio knew of because I had recommended her. I'd worked with the studio for one of their Marvel films. Marvel? No, maybe it wasn't Marvel. Sorry. for one of their franchise films. And Amber is someone that I had really heavily promoted, thought was right for one of the roles in that. And because they saw her in that, they recommended and cast her in Legion, which was a TV series. And she was one of the series regulars in that. So then the studio was aware of her by the time we got to casting Prey, but she had to earn that spot, and she handily did. But there was a lot of competition for that role, but Amber was just, you know, she's just so lovely and articulate and great in interviews, and I'm sure you'll see a lot more from her.
Oh yeah, I mean, she's the star, and that performance was just incredible. And it felt, I mean, I was aware of her from I had a director on here, Steve Pink, who he'd done a very low budget film with her, and I was aware of her through that. And I thought she was great in that. And then when I looked her up, I saw she was the lead in Prey, and I was like, oh wow, this is going to obviously be, you know, huge for her. But I actually didn't realize she was already in a series there. But I mean, you mentioned that you're not a big fan of gore and those sort of things, but you as you say, you've done a lot of projects that involve quite a lot. I mean, you know, the Revenant's pretty savage. I mean, films that, I mean, even like things like The New World, Terrence Malick, things like that, where they're pretty brutal films. And Prey is obviously, I watched Prey with my girlfriend, who's not a big fan of gore, and she had her hands over her face for most of it.
That's how I watch my movies.
Like yeah. When you go to the premiere, you're just like...
I am. I do.
You know, you got nice color skin. What color would you say that is?
My color.
Osage.
They have the worst land possible. But they outsmarted everybody.
The land had oil on it. Black gold. Money flows freely here now.
I do love that money, sir.
And I am hugely looking forward to, and I wish I'd seen it before chatting to you, but Killers of the Flower Moon, which I presume is probably going to be a fairly brutal film as well. You know, working with someone like Scorsese, and I mean, just the team involved in that. How was that working with, you know, you've worked with loads of legends throughout your career. But, you know, being involved with that and working together with Ellen Lewis on the casting, how was that experience?
Getting the call to do this film was a dream and a career highlight. I mean, let me just go back to what you mentioned an earlier film of Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas. Goodfellas has always been one of my favorite films. So just working on anything adjacent to his name was thrilling for me. I had worked with Ellen Lewis on Godless. Mm-mm. We had worked together. And you know what? She is, I can honestly say she is one of my heroes. And it has nothing to do with what she's cast or her career or anything like that. And I've told her this. It has everything to do with who she is as a person. Because she was just so lovely to deal with on that picture, and so to get to work with her again and really closely on a much larger scale on Killers was it was amazing. And you know, we had a lot of stops and starts on that one too, because we had a whole pandemic that we had to deal with for filming. But you know, first and foremost, Ellen is Marty's casting director. And so I early in the process, Ellen was doing the interacting with the director, and I was sending my work to Ellen. And then toward the later part of the process, I was also doing Zooms with him, and lovely, lovely, lovely man. And I don't think I've ever worked with a director who was, who knew what he wanted as quickly. Like, he made decisions very quickly, which I so respect. Because it I mean, it doesn't put any doubt in any person in how they're doing their job. You know, it's like, wow, he likes it. Good. Let's go with this one.
So talented. I mean, I don't need to say that. He's one of the absolute icons. Mm-hmm. I went to see Taxi Driver at the cinema the other day. They had I think it was some sort of anniversary for the film. And just watching that movie now, so many years later, and how effective it still is, and how it's so current. And I actually didn't realize that he was in it as well. I didn't realize Martin Scorsese's one of the guys that gets into the taxi, and he's really great as well as an actor. I've never seen him perform before, but he was brilliant. But yeah, like you say, I'm a huge fan of him, and must be mind blowing to think, wow. You know, from your beginning of your career and now here you are doing these incredible projects. But yeah, I mean, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. I've got to wrap up and ask you one more question. Most embarrassing moments,
yeah. Okay. No, I'm not going to tell that one. Gosh. Okay, I have one, but I don't quite, I don't know how to tell it. It's, do you remember the old early Saturday Night Live.
Right.
It was way before, probably before you were born, I think. There was an actor who did a character that's name was Pat. And Pat, you never knew if Pat was a male or female. And it was never apparent. And that was the joke, I guess. I had a situation where that happened to me. I had an open call in Santa Fe, and this is a terrible story, and it was just because it was so awkward. I didn't know. I did the best I could. I had an open call, and I had laid out all of the stacks of sides, because as I was meeting people, I was going to give them something to go away and work on, like a one page kind of thing to go away and work on and come back, and I would put them on tape. And an individual came in, and I think I'm pretty smart about how to talk to people and figure things out, but everything I said, I couldn't tell if this was a man or a woman. And finally I thought, oh man, Renee, but they had a great look and I definitely wanted them to read. I just didn't know for what role. And finally I was like, I chatted with them for a while and I said, look, you know, since I haven't met you before and I don't know you well, I'm just going to let you look at all of these sides and decide which role would be best for you to read for. Because I want it to be, you know, what you want to do. And I had other people I was dealing with and came back to this individual. And I believe their name was also Pat.
That can go either way as well. You can't tell.
Yeah, because I was like, of course you would ask somebody their name to figure this out. And their name was Patricia. And she came back to me and she said, and she was slightly older. And she says, well, of course I'm going to read this one. It's the only female role. I don't know how PC all of that is in this day and age, that I just couldn't figure it out. But we're talking about the early 90s here. And like
that. But these are the things you have to deal with as well, that it must be really difficult. A situation like that, you don't want to offend anyone and you don't want to step out of line, but you've still got to figure that out. So that's a tricky. Yeah.
It's really difficult. And I mean, I don't want to offend anyone professionally, but honest to God, I don't want to offend anyone personally either. So, you know, as Renee, forget the job. I always make sure I have more than one female role to read for now. But that's not going to happen now. We've evolved and we've learned how to assess these, and these days it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter now anyway. Mm-hmm. So I would say pick any role you want. Mm-hmm. Because you know what, sometimes a female can play a male role. I mean, that's what the casting process is all about, the excitement of changing it up sometimes too.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I love that. And I love that you are open to, you know, not being kind of blinkered, and the way you cast from all the films that you've done and the projects you've done, it's interesting casting, and you don't seem to be afraid to cast, like, not necessarily unknowns, but people that aren't big names, people that are just going to be right for the role, which it's exciting for actors to watch because you're like, it's possible, you know?
It's always possible. And I love telling somebody that they got the job for the first time. I love it. It's the best part of my job.
I love that. Well, thank you, Rania. This has been wonderful. And you're a real inspiration, someone that I really look up to. And hope one day I will be coming in and reading for you one day. So
I hope so too.
Keep my fingers crossed. All the very best with The Killers of the Flower Moon. Not that you're going to need it, because, I mean, it's going to be
huge. Please see it in the theater.
I will 100%.
Phenomenal.
I can't wait. And okay. It's almost as long as Dances with Wolves, I believe. So I'll be sitting down and I'll be getting stuck right in.
It really does fly by. It's so interesting and so well done and so full of things you have never seen before.
$1,000 for any information about these murders.
We need to find the truth about these killings. I know what I gotta do.
Your uncle. Are you scared of him?
I'm gonna tell you who did it.
Oh my God. Killers of the Flower Moon. Rated R. Only in theaters October 20th. Get tickets now.
It's a laugh and film, motherfucker. Subscribe. And like and follow.
Thank you to our guest, Renee. And thank you to Apple. And thank you to 42 West. And as always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.
Well, well, our war hero has arrived.
Killers of the Flower Moon was a series of murders of Osage men and women to bilk them at the discovery of oil on their land.
The Osage Reign of Terror was a fascinating piece of American history.
I was drawn to the idea to tell this terribly tragic story that was never brought to national attention.
Marty, obsessed with telling this story with the most honesty that he possibly could.
One of the key things was that I was drawn to this world where friendship and love existed with blatant extortion, exploitation, and murder.
When this money started coming, we should have known it came with something else.
In our film, Ernest develops a relationship with Molly Burkhart.
I don't know what she said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
Ernest was encouraged to marry her by his uncle, Bill Hale, in order to get her family's shares in the oil profits.
Hale was a very enigmatic presence in Osage country.
He definitely represented somebody that wanted to take advantage of the situation at all costs.
Their time is over.
There was a need to tell this story for Martin Scorsese. There was something intrinsic in him to do this story justice.
There's a sinister nature of the murders of the Osage people.
Expecting a miracle to make all this go away. You know they don't happen anymore.
I wanted to do justice to the Osage so that the audience feels the immensity of the tragedy.